This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hey, it's Ron. This episode was recorded before I launched Politicology, when I hosted the Lincoln Project podcast on this feed. If you have questions, comments, or advice, you can reach us at podcast@politicology.com or find us online at politicology.com. Enjoy. Welcome back. I'm your host, Ron Steslow. In our first episode, you heard from most of the Lincoln Project co-founders, with one notable exception, Jennifer Horn. I'm excited that we'll get to hear from Jennifer today about her time as the chair of the New Hampshire Republican Party. We also talk about why she decided to help build the Lincoln Project, about holding conservative values and deciding to vote against Donald Trump and for Joe Biden, being attacked by the president on Twitter, and her personal experiences of dealing with the devastating consequences of Trump's response to the coronavirus pandemic. Jennifer, thanks so much for taking the time today.
I'm really happy to be here.
Could you start by sharing with our listeners about your background, and how you got into Republican politics, and your long career in this world?
You sound like you're trying to age me, Ron. Such a long career. I just want to say some of the other founders of the project have had much longer careers in politics.
It's true.
You know what? It's interesting because I actually did not get involved in politics until I was about 44 years old. I don't come from a political family. I didn't have any really real political background. I spent the first 12 or 15 years after I got married as a stay-at-home mom. My husband and I have 5 kids together. And it was, you know, after my kids kind of were all in school and all having, you know, leaving me with more time in my day, I got back into writing. You know, my college studies were in communications, and I had a column for the Nashua Telegraph. I had a weekly column there. Then I started into radio, where I was hosting a local talk radio about, you know, politics and community and things like that. And in 2008, I decided, not exactly out of the blue, but certainly a giant leap out of my comfort zone, I decided to run for Congress. And it was because I had spent the last 2 years on the radio following current events, interviewing people from when the Democrats had taken over the House in 2006. And, you know, they saw this as their opportunity, which I have to say, I understand that world much better today than I did when I was kind of jumping into it then. But they had this opportunity to kind of try to reshape the House. And I was in disagreement over a lot of it. But my bigger concern at the time was that we were falling into this mentality of politics as usual. Like, oh, this is just the way it is. This is the Democrats are in charge. They're going to do their thing. Someday the Republicans will beat them. They're going to come back and do their thing. And I just really had this strong sense at that moment that I wanted to make a difference. This is so important, because the farther into politics you get, you kind of stop talking about what it is that brought you in to begin with sometimes. And I think it's important for all of us to kind of, you know, revisit that sometimes and remember what it was, that I really believe that one person can make a difference. That one voice being loud and clear and strong can not only change the trajectory of something, but also, you know, can inspire others to stand up and become involved and to add their voices to it. And for them to, you know, join the group, and the group turns into a crowd, you know, and the crowd turns into millions of people. And so that was kind of my goal at that time, was I just wanted to add my voice to what was happening in the world. I made a couple of promises to myself in 2008 when I made this decision. And the most important one was that whatever I did from that point forward, having anything to do with politics, I would never say or do anything that I could not come home to the dinner table and explain or defend to my children. And I don't think I ever have. I've really been conscious of that, you know, through in all the years since. And so that's what got me involved. Now, I became our party's nominee that year for the second congressional district in New Hampshire. Barack Obama won the White House that year. I did not win.
You were the first woman to ever receive the Republican nomination in New Hampshire. Is that correct?
I was. I was the first Republican woman nominated to federal office. Wow. And I didn't really understand at the time, you know, my focus was so much outside of anything to do with whether or not I was a man or a woman or anything else.
Yeah.
But as I have continued on in Republican politics, I have come to understand and respect more how important that is. Yeah. I do think I'm of two minds. I don't want a woman for the job any more than I want a man for the job. I want somebody who's qualified, intelligent, compassionate, understanding. You know, I can go through all the qualifications mm-hmm. that I want for somebody in any given elected position. But it is ridiculous. It's embarrassing. I can't figure out why we have so few elected Republican women. Because if you look at the House and Senate today, we have fewer today than we've had in the past. You know, it's not. It is a failure of our party that we lack diversity, whether it's women, LGBTQ community, people of color. You know, you kind of go through the whole long list. But we should be able to achieve greater diversity without going out there and saying, okay, I want a Black person, a woman, and a gay person. You guys all get online and run. Like, we shouldn't have to say that. We should naturally be open and embracing all of the people that make up our community, that make up our country. Yeah. It should be a natural process. And it hasn't happened. And that is a failure on the part of our party.
Yeah. And one of the things that I talked with Tara Setmeyer about was the autopsy report in 2012,
mm-hmm.
which you're be familiar with, which spoke to exactly what what you're talking about, which was the need for the party to reach out to minority groups and include them proactively. And maybe that I'd like to pivot to why you helped create the Lincoln Project, and I assume that had something to do with it.
Well, sure. The even before that, the document you're talking about came out of the RNC, right? The National mm-hmm. Leadership Organization of the Republican Party came up with this evaluation of why things went so horribly awry in 2012 when they were expecting that it to go in a different direction. That should be clear too. And so it had a lot to do with digital and, messaging and all sorts of things, but it really focused significantly on the homogenous nature of the party. And Tara's right, you know, I'm sure in her analysis of it. But what I found so interesting about that was that they went through that report went through and laid out very clearly, step by step by step, here's what we're doing wrong, here's what we need to do to be successful, and this is what the American people are looking for. In 2016, we did exactly the opposite on every single step. Mm-hmm. I became chairman of the New Hampshire Republican Party in 2013, and I served for 4 years, two terms, so it was January of 2013 through January of 2017. So I was there through the whole Donald Trump thing.
Oh.
And it was insane. Behind the scenes, the conversations that we were having at the RNC about what's happening, what are we doing, how do we get control of this, all of these things. And it was exactly the opposite of what we knew we needed to do or what we knew we needed to be in order to have any sort of longevity in our, you know, influence or effectiveness, because there was nobody at the RNC, and some of them are still there today. I don't care what they say in front of the camera. They were, you know, I was there. They said it to me. There is nobody at the RNC today who believes that Donald Trump is creating longevity of influence for the Republican Party right now in the way that he is conducting himself.
Is there a moment that stands out to you from that time? Can you take us behind the curtain? And is there
well,
one?
Well, you know what? There are a couple. For me, I spent that whole cycle speaking up against Donald Trump when I felt like I had to. As chairman, you have an obligation to remain neutral in a primary. Mm-hmm. But I also felt like my responsibility as chairman was to articulate and preserve the principles of Republicanism. So I did not take sides. I feel strongly about this. I didn't endorse anybody. I didn't say you should vote for this guy instead of this guy. But any time that I was confronted with having to choose between defending Donald Trump or defending the principles of my party, I chose the principles every time, mm-hmm. which made me not one of Donald Trump's favorite people. But I would say there are two moments that really kind of stand out for me from that. One was when Reince, who was RNC chair at the time, Reince Priebus was in town. He and I were doing a bunch of stuff together, and we were in the back seat of the car. It was in the fall of that of the general election. I don't remember exactly when it took place, but just talking between us about what an absolute horror this had all turned into, and what the consequences would be for the party going forward.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Reince did not believe that there was any chance at all that we would win the White House. And this was just a few weeks out from the election day. And I can remember him saying to me very specifically, his line was, you know, when this is all over, we need to bury it in the backyard and just walk away from it and never think of it again. Wow. And I can remember at the time thinking, yeah, it'd be good if we could, but I don't think you get to do that. And I just thought, but that's kind of, to me, like that just really speaks to, that's how everyone at the RNC felt. No one believed it was going to happen, and none of them really wanted it to happen. Like no one ever said, I want him to lose straight out, but nobody really wanted to have to take on the responsibility of Donald Trump winning as a Republican nominee. And then
Reince Priebus, just so everyone remembers for the record, went on to become, I think it was Donald Trump's first chief of staff.
His first chief of staff. He went on to become his first chief of staff. And when that happened, I was actually encouraged because I knew Reince to be a really good person. I still know Reince to be a very good person, a sincere, compassionate man who wants good in the world. I don't ascribe to this idea that everybody who went into the White House to try to help Donald Trump is automatically evil. I think Reince and some of the people he brought with him went in there and wanted to try to get things under control. They wanted to be part of, making this as successful for our country as possible. But the other moment that stands out that was even more impactful for me was, I believe it was after the Billy Bush tape came out. Mm. And, there were some folks on Trump's New Hampshire team that I had been friends with and had worked with on many political effort over the previous 10 years, people that I respected, that I liked. And one of them was, one of the top dogs on his team. And he called me. I was in the car driving with my husband to some political something. I don't know if it was, a rally or a phone bank, whatever it was. And he called and he said, look, I heard from your guys, that you're going to say something. And I said, yeah, I'm going to say something. Of course, I have to say something. And He's like, you don't have to say anything. He said, like, our teams are finally working well together. Cause you can imagine there was some tension between the guys that worked for me and the guys that worked for Trump. And he said, our teams are working really good together. We're almost done with this. We're, you know, we're going to be able to put it behind us soon. He's like, just don't say anything. And I said, I can't just not say anything. Like, think about that. Think about what that tape said and what that, you know, what was, you know, how horrible that was. I said, I can't just not say anything. And I said to him, I promised myself a long time ago that I would never say or do anything I could not defend to my children. I have to say something. And his answer from this guy that I had liked and respected all these years and had worked with, who had helped me get elected chairman, in just the most derisive tone, saying, oh, come on, you're going to give me that line like it's about your kids? And for me, that was... I was like, all right, done, check. Yeah. I know, right?
It tells you all you need to know.
That's all I need to know. So, so that has really, you know, that shaped, that promise to myself shaped everything I ever said or did in politics. It continues to today. And I have learned now that it also gave me a good filter to understand other people in politics, for good or for bad.
Yeah. So let's talk about the Lincoln Project now. Because all eight of us have our own stories, our own backgrounds, and we're all on different journeys. But those journeys have intersected at this project, and they may depart once this is over. We have a singular mission to defeat Donald Trump and Trumpism in November. So I wonder if you can talk about what brought you to the Lincoln Project, what your reasons are for helping create it, given everything that you've been through in Republican politics.
Sure. The you know, it is interesting because when other people have asked me about this, I've given very similar answers to what you just laid out. We were all on these parallel paths. You know, we were all equally committed to making sure that Donald Trump does not get elected to president again, taking our own approach or, our, you know, maybe involved in different groups, different efforts, our op-eds, all that sort of thing. And the Lincoln Project is where we all came together. And, you know, we all kind of merged into one lane. And all I can say is, like, I look at what we've been able to accomplish in the last, since December, and it's astounding. You know, none of us are so egotistical that we look at this and say, oh yeah, we knew we were going to we knew this was going
to
happen.
It was a complete surprise to everyone.
Right. Yeah. But including ourselves, we have exceeded our own expectations. And so, you know, it was one of the, you know, the first time, I guess for me, you know, why now, you know, how did we end up here and what brought me here? The first time that I ever publicly spoke against Donald Trump as a leader or an elected member of our party was actually in April of 2011. Donald Trump came to New Hampshire to test the waters for the 2012 cycle. He came to New Hampshire for one event, one small, very controlled event. I think it was, I don't know if he ever left the airport. It might've been over there. And I wrote an op-ed that was published in the Union Leader the day that he was in town. And I laid out the case for why not Donald Trump then. Now, that was before I was chairman, anybody. I mean, I had already, you know, run for Congress and been the nominee, and I was involved in other types of activist activities. And I can remember one line in that very clearly saying, if the Republican Party takes him seriously, they deserve what they get. And I go back and reread that now, and there is not a single, every single line of that op-ed has come to fruition, has turned out to be true. I made no predictions there that were overblown or outrageous. They've all happened. And so that's how far back it goes for me, specifically about Donald Trump. And I think for all of us, probably all eight of us, we've been part of and been watching for 3.5 years, you know, constant every day asking ourselves, what's going to take him down? Like, what else could he possibly say or do that would be incompetent or horrible? And still nobody seems to care. His numbers are, you know, right where they are, you know, right where you want him to be for reelection. He, you know, his supporters are never going to leave him. Like, oh my God, are we going to be, you know, stuck with this guy forever? And so I think, you know, and I don't know if you realize this or not, briefly last year from about February until June, in different capacities. I was also involved in Bill Weld's efforts.
Yeah, so I remember. We talked during that campaign.
That's right. And so that's part of you know, when the guys from, you know, who were putting the link in, when John and Reed reached out to me, I had already been through that and left that. And so for me, it was, you know, sort of an understanding that nobody else is going to do it. I keep waiting for somebody to do something. Nobody else is going to do it. Nobody else is doing anything effective. Nobody else is going to, you know, nobody else has figured this out. So yeah, if you guys are doing something and you want me to be part of it, I'm in.
Yeah. What do you think is so significant about this moment that we're in 2020, why do you think the Lincoln Project is so important now versus because you've been at this for quite a while, right? And
well, we've already established that, right? I'm very old. No, I've been around forever.
I mean, at this in terms of criticizing Donald Trump all the way back to 2011.
Right.
And so what is so significant about right now? Why the Lincoln Project right now?
Right. Well, it's really interesting to me. You know, we launched in December of last year. Yeah. And at that time period, the whole impeachment thing was coming to a head. And a lot of folks asked us at that time, so this, you guys want to get him impeached? Is this an effort to make sure he gets impeached? And our answer was always no. Do we think he should be impeached? Yeah. But we're here to defeat him at the ballot box. Because, I mean, who knew, who really believed that the Republicans were going to defeat Donald Trump? Sure. So, and we always said our mission is to defeat Donald Trump and Trumpism at the ballot box. And what has unfolded since that time, first with the pandemic and then with the racial unrest across the country, I mean, who would ever have guessed in December of last year that anything could happen that would be, that would show Donald Trump to be more incompetent, more weak, more egotistical, more narcissistic, more dangerous, more ignorant, more, you know? And so I look at it in this moment right now, and what I understand and what I hope desperately that people across the country understand is that this election is going to shape the world that our grandchildren raise their families in. Mm-hmm. It is going to be that influential, and for generations beyond that, that it is so critical that the American people send a loud, clear message that is just undeniable, irrefutable, that it is such an overwhelming defeat of Donald Trump, that the world, and more importantly, that history know that we came together and rejected the very idea of an American president building a reelection campaign on on racism. Excuse me. That they know that the American people came together and rejected the idea of an American president basing a reelection campaign on racism. It has to happen now. And people, you know, ask about it and they talk about it all the time. Do you really think it will happen? Do you think we can defeat him? Of course we can defeat him. Of course we can. But Ron, only if everybody puts aside their partisan differences, their social and community disagreements. Mm-hmm. This is just for this one moment. We all have to stand together. We have to understand that my voice makes a difference. Your voice makes a difference. CJ's voice makes a difference. Mm-hmm. Every voice has to be heard. And this is the moment when that has to happen for the preservation of the Republic and to preserve the kind of world that you want future generations of your family to grow up in.
So, Jennifer, on May 5th of this year, which was shortly after the Lincoln Project released our Morning in America ad, which went viral and struck a nerve with a lot of Americans because it was true. There's one American whose nerves it struck who lives in the White House. And shortly after that ad, after he watched it, he lashed out at the Lincoln Project and several of our founders, including you. And And I wonder if you could talk about what it's like to be attacked, to be name-checked by the President of the United States on Twitter.
Yeah, that was bizarre at best, you know. Normally, I'm in bed and asleep at that time. It was just completely coincidental that I was up and writing. You know, I was working on my computer. So when it happened, somebody reached out to me right away to say, hey, do you see what the president just said? So I kind of, you know, saw it in real time. And it is at best bizarre. A lot of folks say, hey, it's a badge of honor. You should print that tweet out and frame it on your wall and things like that. I really don't want, I don't embrace it that way, because I think when the president attacks, whether he's attacking me or you or any, when he personally attacks somebody on Twitter, other than maybe Vladimir Putin, we don't know what it's like for the president to attack Vladimir Putin. He doesn't do
Never
that,
done it.
Right? He's not on his list. But when he's out there attacking average Americans by name on Twitter, that's incredibly bad for America. That is so bad for our country. It is destructive. It's divisive. It eats away at the foundation of what the presidency is and what the presidency is supposed to be. So while we all kind of joked about it amongst ourselves, I really don't think it's funny, and I don't think it's funny when he attacks women for their appearance. I don't think it's funny when he attacks Gold Star families. I don't think it's funny when he attacks military heroes. Especially after they have passed away. You know, I can go through my whole list. It's not funny. And it's something that the American people should be really offended by and really worried about. When the president of the United States, I mean, just picture it. Is he sitting up in bed with his covers up to his waist, watching Fox News or something with his phone in his hand and his two, you know, pudgy little thumbs, tapping away. Like, I'm just picturing what does it mean that the President of the United States is tweeting at me at 1 o'clock in the morning?
It's like, I mean, the thing that, at that moment,
it's just so revealing of his mental instability.
Yeah,
he is not a stable guy.
But that the thing that is keeping him awake at night is not the pandemic that is ravaging the country, but actually the fact that he saw an ad that was unflattering, that he that resonated with with millions of Americans as true, and his reflex was to lash out and attack the Lincoln Project, the people who were standing up to him.
So he wasn't in bed reading a brief on the best response to the global pandemic. He was not, you know, meeting with some of his folks about the threat that Vladimir Putin and Russia pose to free and fair elections in America. He wasn't worried about the trade war with China that he is losing. You know, we can go through the list.
Yeah.
He wasn't
yeah.
sitting there going, okay, let's see. South Korea figured out how to beat this virus. What did they do that we can do? We can go through the list of the hundreds of ways that the President of the United States could have been using his time at 1 o'clock in the morning if he wasn't asleep. And it was none of them. It was a petty, adolescent, weak-minded personal grievance that he was concerned about.
I want to talk a little bit about people with conservative values like yourself, and how you might advise American voters who are like you and don't want to let go of those conservative values and are struggling to reconcile that with voting for Donald Trump or not voting for Donald Trump this year. You said previously, I think, to the New Hampshire Journal, I haven't moved from my conservative principles. I'm still pro-life, pro-Second Amendment, pro-small government, and Trump isn't really any of those things. There are people listening right now who are genuinely on the fence.
Right.
And I asked Steve Schmidt this question. He said, I'm probably not the right guy. Maybe you're the right person to speak to that.
Steve Schmidt is a really smart guy. And I, as you know, after being at the Cooper Union event with Lincoln Project, nobody wants to go on after Steve Schmidt.
True. Is, you're in the hot
that
seat
is not
now.
Cool.
Yeah. But there are people listening who are genuinely wondering what to do. And they've never had to face this kind of choice before.
And so I have, you know, several thoughts about that. The first is, I totally get that you're on the fence. I totally get that. I spent 10 years building the Republican Party and getting Republicans elected and raising money for Republicans and, you know, running a field operation and building a party around getting Republicans elected. And never in my life have I ever voted for a Democrat as of this moment in my life. Obviously, in November of 2020, I'll be voting for a Democrat. So the fact that you're on the fence and you're hesitant, you're confused, of course you are. I totally understand that. If your hesitance is based in the idea that you are a conservative and you, how can I possibly vote for Joe Biden if I'm a conservative? I would think a little bit about what conservatism really is. Conservatism is not racist. It is not judgmental of people based on the color of their skin, their sexual orientation, their gender, their financial circumstances, the level of their education, whether or not they have served in the military, whether or not they like you. You know, think about you when you compare Donald Trump as a human being to conservatism as a philosophy, there is no overlap. There's no overlap. So, you know, and let's take life as an issue for, as an example. But I'm pro-life. How can I vote for Joe Biden? I'm pro-life. Well, what does pro-life mean to you? Pro-life is not just about being opposed to women having an abortion. Pro-life means that you believe that life is inherently valuable. So that must also mean that you believe that elderly people who are living in assisted living facilities should not be dying of a pandemic that only exists in our country in the destructive nature that it does because Donald Trump does not care about elderly people living in an assisted living facility. He only cares about what will make him look more electable. If you are pro-life, then you cannot possibly believe that putting children who were brought to America by their parents completely out of their own control into cages and take them away from their parents, and to this day, many of them not be reunited with their parents. Mm-hmm. If you are pro-life, you cannot possibly believe that under any circumstance, children belong in cages. And it doesn't matter if somebody else did it before or if somebody else did it, but not as much or worse. Or it doesn't. That is not pro-life. So I think that when people who are looking at this election saying, God, but I'm a conservative, I've never voted for a Democrat before, you need to think about each of those issues one at a time and say, wait, anybody, I defy you to give me an example of where Donald Trump has ever expressed or acted in a manner that shows value for life, that shows that he finds your life in some way sacred. He doesn't. So he and the same would be true if you looked, you know, he's going to drain the swamp. Donald Trump is the biggest swamp monster in the history of our country. He was, you know, limited government. No, he has grown government and wants to get more into your personal life than ever before. Equal rights. Donald Trump's administration went to the Supreme Court to fight against equal rights for all Americans. What about the Constitution and the Bill of Rights? Donald Trump has fought against your right, not the press, not the big mean media that he's, you know, that he has convinced you is your enemy. He has fought against your right to free speech. Every day that he attacks on social media or the press or anything else, he's trying to silence individual Americans. So you're a conservative? So am I. I get it. Donald Trump is not a conservative. And nothing that he's doing is going to make it easier for anybody in the future to make the argument for conservatism. It is exactly the opposite.
You mentioned the pandemic and elderly people who have been struggling, not just to tease apart misinformation from truth throughout this catastrophe, but also access to testing, access to medical care. And you have your own story dealing with this, caring for elderly parents. And would you be willing to share a little bit about that?
Yes. And you know, there are two things in particular that happened that really, that I feel like really kind of highlights what so many, like it is, you know, it's my story, but it's millions of Americans' story. And it's only one piece of how this pandemic has really hurt individual human beings. You know, my parents are both elderly, and they spend a couple of months every winter in Florida. And for the past several years, my husband and I go with them. We both work from home, and my parents need family. You know, we're in a condition, they need family near them. And so this year, when we were down there, we happened to be in Florida when this whole thing hit and the lockdown started. So we were locked down with my 83 and 85 year old mom and dad. And a lot of that was a joyful experience for us. You know, we choose to be in Florida with them in the wintertime to help them and to take care of them. But my mom was very, very frail and has been for a couple of years now. And early on in all of this developed some sort of a respiratory infection. And naturally, since, you know, a week before the shutdown, mom and I had been in Disney World together, you know, pushing her through the crowds in her wheelchair. And so a week or two into it, she developed a respiratory disease of some sort. And I just wanted to take her to her regular PCP in Florida to find out, you know, what's wrong. My mom's having progressively getting harder for her to breathe. She's got, you know, all these symptoms. And over the course of 3 days, I spoke to her doctor's office repeatedly. And I could not bring my sick mother to the doctor because they were worried she might be sick. You know, think about that. They said, her symptoms sound too much like COVID, so we can't have her in the office. So the best thing is if she gets really sick, if she gets to where she can't breathe, then bring her to the emergency room. But be careful about bringing her to the emergency room because she could catch COVID there if she doesn't already have it. It was insane. And I finally, as my mom over the course of a few days got sicker and sicker, I finally realized the only way I'm going to get her treatment is if I can prove that she doesn't have the coronavirus. Mm-hmm. So I got online for the first drive-through test that they had near where my parents live, got up to our turn, lied to them and said, yes, the doctor told us to come and get, you know, tested. And so they tested my mom. By the time it took, I believe, 15 or 17 days to get the results. So by the time we got the results and knew she didn't have the coronavirus, we were already past the critical part. But the next day we're at home testing her oxygen level because she's slumped over in her chair. She's barely conscious. And it shows us something in the low 80s, which it's anything under 90 is critical, supposedly. So I've got the ambulance on the way, the EMTs in the living room, loading my poor mom, who doesn't know what's going on, onto this stretcher. We follow them to the emergency room. They won't let any of us go in near my mom. I had to find out. And the whole time I'm sitting there saying she has dementia. She doesn't know where she is. She cannot speak for herself. I mean, it was just, I had to fight to get back there with her. And the first thing the doctor, with all due respect, the idiot doctor said to me is, well, she's been back here for 45 minutes, you know, looking for you. Where have you been? We can't, you know, we don't even know why she's here. Like, I've been outside in your lobby trying to fight to get in here. It was insane. It was completely insane. Turned out my mom had acute bronchitis and recovered. Thank God.
All the while, Donald Trump was telling Americans, anybody who wants a test can get a test, no problem. Fast forward to where we are today, and he's in the process of shutting down funding for all tests all around the country effective June 30th.
Exactly. Yeah. If you want a test, you can get a test. Tests are everywhere. No problem with tests. And now he wants to defund tests, which, by the way, and that's the thing for people to understand. When I, you know, back to what I said earlier, you got to look at this and just be clear with yourself. The purpose for shutting down tests is so that voters who are thinking about whether or not they want to vote for Donald Trump won't keep hearing how many people in America have actually caught the coronavirus. Yeah. That's the purpose.
Yeah. So it's all about the numbers for him.
We get to a point where it's clear the lockdown's going to continue much longer than anybody anticipated. Flights are getting canceled. Nobody can travel. My parents live in upstate New York. Just being in lockdown made my mother worse. She was disconnected from the outside world. Her dementia was getting worse. She clearly was not feeling well. And we reached a point as a family where we decided we need to get them home. We booked flights. They got canceled. We booked another flight. It got canceled. My husband and I ended up renting an RV, scrubbing it down, putting my parents in it, and driving 1,200 miles through the night to get them home. And I am so grateful now in retrospect that I did that, because about a month after we got home, my mom passed away. And had that happened while we were in Florida, away from family and away from the familiar, you know, places and home and friends and everything, I don't know how my dad would have survived it. But the experience of going through a death and a funeral and the mourning while under the coronavirus was awful. You could not have a public funeral mass. My mother and father are lifelong Catholics. Their faith is the fuel for their, you know, their lives. And the idea that we couldn't have their friends gather in a church was really awful for my dad. And he didn't understand. He just did not understand the degree to which all of this was impacting everything. You could not have a wake. You couldn't, in where we were, you know, at that point, you can only have 20 people in the building at a time at a funeral home. And as a family, we overcame it. You know, we all got to get it. Our family, our immediate family, is 9 children, 8 spouses and 37 grandchildren. Wow. So we're a little bit of a crowd. We got together in Dad's backyard and, we had a mass for my mom. And we all went to the funeral home and went in small groups, you know, little by little. And we kind of tailgated in the parking lot together in between as we were waiting our turn to go inside. We made it work, you know, because we're a family and we came together and we took care of each other. But the more I think back on that experience, the more I think about this is just a little thing in the big picture of how coronavirus has caused loss and heartache and burden for millions of Americans. People in the end of my mom's life, she was in the hospital for a week. We had to fight to get permission for one of us to be in the hospital with her that whole time because she cannot speak for herself. And the longer she's alone and away from her family, the worse the her condition got, and the more frightened and out of control she would become. Like, we had to fight to be able to be there next to her. So I think about all the family, all the people in our country whose loved ones died alone in a hospital, whose loved ones right now cannot get the cancer care treatment they need or the get into you know, trials, experimental trials, because the coronavirus has limited access to that. And you can go through the list. You think about 120,000 American lives lost to this disease in just a few months, and your heart just aches. And then you go beyond that and realize the degree to which it is really hurting people. Even beyond that, every day, minute by minute, it is not politicizing a tragedy to say Donald Trump is responsible for the heartache and the burden and the loss that the American people are feeling right now. It was his weakness, his incompetence, and his narcissism that led him to make the decisions that has turned this into something that is much bigger and much heavier than it ever had to be for our country. Donald Trump is responsible for that. That's not being political. That's being honest.
If you had 5 minutes alone in a room with Donald Trump, what would you say to him?
I have thought about that. You asked me that a couple of days ago, and I thought about that. And I think that the honest answer at this point in my life is that I would decline the opportunity. I've had the chance to talk to Donald Trump a few times during the election when I was chairman. And the one time when it was just the two of us one-on-one by phone, the conversation went for 2 minutes and 7 seconds, and he never stopped speaking. He called because I had been speaking out against him. One of his people said, you need to call and make nice with this chairman so she stops criticizing you. And, you know, we connected on the phone. And at that time, I just wanted to talk to him about how the way he was campaigning was making it harder for Senator Kelly Ayotte to win re-election to the Senate, and that I thought there was a better path for both of them. And my husband can attest to this. He was sitting right next to me. I spent the entire 2 minutes and 7 seconds saying, but Kelly, Senator Ayotte, I'm not kidding. He did not stop speaking. He didn't know. I'm sure that he didn't even bother registering in his head who he was talking to. He spent 2 minutes and 7 seconds talking about the polls, how great he was doing in the polls. Look at me in the polls. I'm great. We're going to win. We're in poll, all about the polls. And when he finally got to the end, and I thought, okay, this is my chance. And I started to jump in. He said, so you call me anytime you need something, you call me, you have my number. And like essentially hung up. So there is Donald Trump is not capable of hearing anything I have to say to him. Would I like to tell him the story about my mom? Absolutely. If I thought it would impact the way that he was thinking or acting or, you know, leading, you know, would I like to share with him, you know, ideas that I have or thoughts that I have about a better way to preserve America, my feelings about, you know, how great our country is and equality and opportunity and service? Sure. But why at this point would I waste 5 minutes of my time sitting in front of the weakest, most dangerous, most divisive person we've ever had in the White House? He does not care. He doesn't want to hear from me. He would not listen to me if I was there. And that, I don't mean that as me like, oh, Jennifer Horn, you should listen to me. That's me as in every single American citizen. He does not care. If you're not there telling him, one, that he's great, or two, this is how you win, he does not care. I think that's the answer to what would I say to Donald Trump.
This episode was recorded when I hosted the Lincoln Project podcast on this feed. If you have any questions or advice, you can reach us at podcast@politicology.com. And please know that even if we don't respond, we read every email we get, and we love hearing from you. If you enjoy the show, it would help us if you could rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Ron Steslow. I'll see you in the next episode.